It is true that I share the stand of Hank Reardon. His political convictions are mine. You have heard him denounced in the past as a reactionary who opposed every step, measure, slogan, and premise of the present system. Now you hear him praised as our greatest industrialist, whose judgment on the value of economic policies may safely be trusted. It is true. You may trust his judgment. If you are now beginning to fear that you are in the power of an irresponsible evil, that the country is collapsing and that you will soon be left to starve, consider the views of our ablest industrialist, who knows what conditions are necessary to make production possible and to permit a country to survive. Consider all that you know about his views. At such times as he was able to speak, you have heard him tell you that this government's policies were leading you to enslavement and destruction. Yet he did not denounce the final climax of these policies, Directive 10-289. You have heard him fighting for his rights, his and yours, for his independence, for his property. Yet he did not fight, Directive 10-289. He signed voluntarily, so you have been told, the gift certificate that surrendered Reardon metal to his enemies. He signed the one paper which, by all of his previous record, you had expected him to fight to the death. What could this mean? You have constantly been told. Unless it meant that even he recognized the necessity of Directive 10-289 and sacrificed his personal interests for the sake of the country. Judge his views by the motive of that action, you have constantly been told. And with this, I agree unreservedly. Judge his views by the motive of that action, and, for whatever value you attach to my opinion, and to any warning I may give you, judge my views also by the motive of that action, because his convictions are mine. For 2 years I had been Hank Reardon's mistress. Let there be no misunderstanding about it. I am saying this not as a shameful confession, but with the highest sense of pride. I had been his mistress. I had slept with him, in his bed, in his arms. There is nothing anyone might now say to you about me which I will not tell you first. It will be useless to defame me. I know the nature of the accusations, and I will state them to you myself. Did I feel a physical desire for him? I did. Was I moved by a passion of my body? I was. Have I experienced the most violent form of sensual pleasure? I have. If this now makes me a disgraced woman in your eyes, let your estimate be your own concern. I will stand on mine. Bertram Scudder was staring at her. This was not the speech he had expected, and he felt in dim panic that it was not proper to let it continue. But she was the special guest whom the Washington rulers had ordered him to treat cautiously. He could not be certain whether he was now supposed to interrupt her or not. Besides, he enjoyed hearing this sort of story. In the audience booth, James Taggart and Lillian Reardon sat frozen, like animals paralyzed by the headlight of a train rushing down upon them. They were the only ones present who knew the connection between the words they were hearing and the theme of the broadcast. It was too late for them to move. They dared not assume the responsibility of a movement or of whatever was to follow. In the control room, a young intellectual of Chick Morrison's staff stood ready to cut the broadcast off the air in case of trouble. But he saw no political significance in the speech he was hearing, no element he could construe as dangerous to his masters. He was accustomed to hearing speeches extorted by unknown pressure from unwilling victims, and he concluded that this was the case of a reactionary forced to confess a scandal, and that therefore the speech had perhaps some political value. Besides, he was curious to hear it. I am proud that he had chosen me to give him pleasure, and that it was he who had been my choice. It was not, as it is for most of you, an act of casual indulgence and mutual contempt. It was the ultimate form of our admiration for each other, with full knowledge of the values by which we made our choice. We are those who do not disconnect the values of their minds from the actions of their bodies, those who do not leave their values to empty dreams, but bring them into existence, those who give material form to thoughts and reality to values, those who make steel, railroads, and happiness. And to such among you who hate the thought of human joy, who wish to see men's life as chronic suffering and failure, who wish men to apologize for happiness or for success or ability or achievement or wealth, to such among you, I am now saying, I wanted him, I had him, I was happy. I had known joy, a pure, full, guiltless joy the joy you dread to hear confessed by any human being, the joy of which your only knowledge is in your hatred for those who are worthy of reaching it. Well, hate me, then, because I reached it.
Miss Taggart, said Bertram Scudder nervously, are we departing from the subject? After all, your personal relationship with Mr. Reardon has no political significance, which
I didn't think it had either, and of course I came here to tell you about the political and moral system under which you are now living. Well, I thought that I knew everything about Hank Reardon, but there was one thing which I did not learn until today. It was the blackmail threat that our relationship would be made public that forced Hank Reardon to sign the gift certificate surrendering Reardon metal. It was blackmail. Blackmail by your government officials, by your rulers, by your... In the instant when Scudder's hand swept out to knock the microphone over, a faint click came from its throat as it crashed to the floor, signifying that the intellectual cop had cut the broadcast off the air. She laughed, but there was no one to see her and to hear the nature of her laughter. The figures rushing into the glass enclosure were screaming at one another. Chick Morrison was yelling unprintable curses at Bertram Scudder. Bertram Scudder was shouting that he had been opposed to the whole idea, but had been ordered to do it. James Taggart looked like an animal baring its teeth, while he snarled at two of Morrison's youngest assistants and avoided the snarls of an older third. The muscles of Lillian Reardon's face had an odd slackness, like the limbs of an animal lying in the road, intact but dead. The morale conditioners were shrieking what they guessed they thought Mr. Mooch would think.
What am I to say to them?
The program announcer was crying, pointing at the microphone.
Mr. Morrison, there's an audience waiting. What am I to say?
Nobody answered him. They were not fighting over what to do, but over whom to blame. Nobody said a word to Dagny or glanced in her direction. Nobody stopped her when she walked out. She stepped into the first taxicab in sight, giving the address of her apartment. As the cab started, she noticed that the dial of the radio on the driver's panel was lighted and silent, crackling with the brief, tense coughs of static. It was tuned to Bertram Scudder's program. She lay back against the seat, feeling nothing but the desolation of the knowledge that the sweep of her action had, perhaps, swept away the man who might never wish to see her again. She felt for the first time the immensity of the hopelessness of finding him, if he did not choose to be found, in the streets of the city, in the towns of a continent, in the canyons of the Rocky Mountains where the goal was closed by a screen of rays. But one thing remained to her, like a log floating on a void, the log to which she had clung through the broadcast. And she knew that this was the thing she could not abandon, even were she to lose all the rest. It was the sound of his voice saying to her, "Nobody stays here by faking reality in any manner whatever."
"Ladies and gentlemen," the voice of Bertram Scudder's announcer cracked suddenly out of the static, "due to technical difficulties over which we have no control, the station will remain off the air pending the necessary readjustments."
The taxi driver gave a brief, contemptuous chuckle and snapped the radio off. When she stepped out and handed him a bill, he extended the change to her and suddenly leaned forward for a closer look at her face. She felt certain that he recognized her, and she held his glance austerely for an instant. His bitter face and his overpatched shirt were worn out by a hopeless losing struggle. As she handed him a tip, he said quietly, with too earnest, too solemn an emphasis for a mere acknowledgment of the coins, "Thank you, ma'am." She turned swiftly and hurried into the building, not to let him see the emotion which was suddenly more than she could bear. Her head was drooping as she unlocked the door of her apartment, and the light struck her from below, from the carpet. Before she jerked her head up in astonishment at finding the apartment lighted, she took a step forward and saw Hank Reardon standing across the room. She was held still by two shocks. One was the sight of his presence. She had not expected him to be back so soon. The other was the sight of his face. His face had so firm, so confident, so mature a look of calm in the faint half-smile, in the clarity of the eyes, that she felt as if he had aged decades within 1 month, but aged in the proper sense of human growth, aged in vision, in stature, in power. She felt that he who had lived through a month of agony, he whom she had hurt so deeply and was about to hurt more deeply still, he would now be the one to give her support and consolation. His would be the strength
to protect them both. She stood motionless for only an instant, but she saw his smile deepening as if he were reading her thoughts and telling her that she had nothing to fear. She heard a slight crackling sound and saw on a table beside him the lighted dial of a silent radio. Her eyes moved to his as a question, and he answered by the faintest nod, barely more than a lowering of his eyelids. He had heard her broadcast.